Welcome to the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, we're going to be talking about three different subjects today. We're going to start off talking about Donald Trump's troubles over in America. We'll be looking at his approval rating and how he'll be reacting to the latest week in what seems to be a series of weeks of scandals facing President Trump. He always seems to bounce back, though, so just how serious is this week for him? We'll be talking about fake news, neat segue there. YouGov have done a poll for Channel 4 looking at public concern in the UK around the so-called fake news phenomenon. Just how worried are they about it? And what does it mean for the future of the media in this country? And then finally, we'll be looking at the fourth or fifth or something like that in the series of our polls with Opinion, the Polling Matters, the latest Polling Matters Opinion survey, where we'll be looking at immigration. And as we're trying to do with lots of these polls, we want to get under the skin of some of the nuance behind the issue. We all know that immigration is an important and salient issue to the British people. It's critical to why Britain voted to leave the European Union. But what is some of the nuance behind it, and what are people concerned about, and what do they think about immigration more generally? We'll be looking at that later in the show. So to dive through some of these numbers, it is a pretty numbers-heavy show this week, but that's okay. That's what Polling Matters is all about. It's Harry Carr, head of Sky Data. Harry, welcome back.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And Leo Barassi, for a third week in a row, you're spoiling us with your presence, Leo.
Hello, Kieran.
So thanks, guys, for being here. I guess let's start on President Donald Trump. I feel like I have to give him the respect of not calling him the Donald. It's been
not, don't feel it that strongly.
I mean, he might as long as he doesn't sort of see this podcast and tweet abuse at it. Although I imagine the ratings would go up.
A lot more listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. But let's start with his approval rating. There's been Gallup do their daily approval rating tracker, which I should say off the bat is not one of the more favourable towards Donald Trump. There are other polls that give him better numbers. But it does seem, Leo, I'll come to you first, that there is movement against President Trump in the numbers. Around the time of his inauguration, on the 22nd of January, 45% of Americans approved and 45% disapproved. As of yesterday, Valentine's Day, he wasn't feeling the love too much. 40% approved, 52% disapproved. I don't know about you, I often find it quite difficult to know just how much trouble Donald Trump's in, because whenever we seem to think that he's in deep shtook, it turns out not to be the case. I mean, what do you make of some of these numbers?
Oh, it's a fair point. He doesn't have an election to fight for another 4 years, so overall headline numbers perhaps aren't that worrying, but they've started low, they're drifting down. I think you can make a case it's starting to have an effect. So there certainly has been word that people who he was going to visit, so site visits to factories and so on, are worried about him coming because of the potential for there being protests, and are pulling out of meeting him. And unpopularity breeds unpopularity. So once it becomes there becomes a sense that he's doing badly, then he sort of potentially becomes toxic, and it starts being harder to get things done. So even though he doesn't have an election for 4 years, other people have got elections a lot sooner. And at the point at which those around him feel that they've got to distance themselves, then he's got a problem with his agenda.
Sure. I mean, Harry, I'll bring you in now. By historic standards, you know, he assumes office with a very low approval rating. But does that mean that it's a ceiling almost, or is this something that he can turn around?
I mean, since they've started doing polling, basically, there's never been a president who's ended their presidency higher than they started it. Like, it tends to be a fairly high point on the scale, with the exception of something, a 9/11 style huge boost up. It's going to take something really big for Trump to come anywhere near Obama, for example. He started on, what, 40% approval rating. Obama started on 80-ish sort of percent approval rating. And being able to deal with that is going to be a real problem. There was a particular poll I saw today from Iowa showing he only had 42% approval there, and sort of those kind of areas, losing those people, the people who voted for him in Iowa, not necessarily as surprisingly as in other Rust Belt states. But if he loses the core support of of the people who have kind of potentially struggled a little bit more, who he was really reaching out to in his kind of almost dystopian American carnage rhetoric that he's kind of pushed out at the moment, what the whole travel ban has been kind of all about aiming at. He's kind of thrown absolutely everything at that, and if he's still only on 42%, that does not bode well for him going forward if he continues on the path he currently is.
That said, there is, as we would expect, a kind of partisan divide on a lot of these numbers. I was looking at a different Gallup poll, which I thought was a bit more encouraging for Trump. So it asked about a series of statements and basically whether they applied or didn't apply to Donald Trump. So just to go, I won't go through all of them, but just to go through some of them, 62% think that Donald Trump is someone, of Americans, this is in total, is someone that keeps his promises. Now, you may disagree of what those promises are and whether they should be kept, but that still is not a bad thing to have as part of your brand, I would argue. And just to go through some of these numbers, a strong and decisive leader, 59% thought that applied to him, 40% didn't. I do think it's interesting that they don't really use don't knows. Some of the more negative numbers, can manage the government effectively, 55% said that did not apply, whereas 44% said it did. And then honest and trustworthy, 57% said that did not apply, 42% said it did. So I suppose this sort of goes back to a point I've made, I think, in the past, which is that you can disagree with him strongly on policy terms, and I understand why people do, but my suspicion is if you want to win over converts to the idea that you shouldn't vote for Trump in the future, maybe it's the competence issue that we always come back to in elections that's more important. But just again, to make the point on being on the partisan nature of some of these numbers, if you split it by Democrats and Republicans, and they've split it actually by Republican leaners and Democrat leaners, 80% or more of Republicans think these statements apply in a positive way towards Donald Trump, whereas the numbers are very negative for Democrats. So it's an interesting debate, Leo, isn't it? Because I suppose on the one hand, we can see how Trump might get worse in terms of his approval ratings, but America is a deeply divided nation by party. And if he can hold on to that Republican base, then he's kind of okay, isn't he?
Yeah, though I think there are two issues with that argument. I mean, the first is to treat the Republican base as an undifferentiated mass, I think, is probably not a great level of analysis. That I think there are a lot of softer supporters of his there who, if he fails to deliver change and looks incompetent, then he's got a real problem. The other half of it, though, is certainly for the midterms, turnout for the Democrats is always going to be an issue, and it's not irrelevant if a lot of Democrats hate Trump more than they might otherwise. The opposition to Trump and being able to say we need to elect Democrats to be able to stop Trump's agenda could potentially be quite a useful motivating thing and getting more people to turn out to vote. So I wouldn't dismiss the significance of the strength of opposition to him amongst people who were never going to vote for him anyway.
To be honest, I think the can manage the government effectively number surprises me, just because actually it's quite high, that 44% of people do think that he can, despite the fact that, you know, a few weeks in, everything he's kind of done has been a little bit sort of roughshod and rushed and without the sort of proper due diligence that usually comes with gigantic things like his
travel. Do you think that's to do with him being not a typical politician and a businessman politician thing, that his sort of pre-government promise was I'm someone who can sort things out and manage things.
Probably the CEO of America,
right,
Inc.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
Probably, exactly. And 86% of Republicans think that applies, so there's obviously an element of partisanship going on.
I mean, people who support the stuff he's done so far will presumably like the fact that he's done it and will kind of agree with the fact that he can manage stuff, even if actually you kind of get into the detail over the execution isn't really what they're talking about. But if you can keep it that, I think, you know, Jeremy Corbyn would die for those kind of figures. So
who knows what's to come in the future. One of the things we were talking about off air, Harry, was this idea. We all have a bet on politics. I think it's safe to say a fair amount of people that listen to this show do, given that it's hosted on politicalbetting.com. there is a market on impeachment, isn't there?
There is. So I saw this today that I think he's evens to be impeached or resign before his four-year period is up. And I think it's something like 4-1. I think it's on Paddy Power to go within the year, which seem quite short odds to me. Like that's
they're ridiculous odds.
Mince your words, Egg.
I rarely, I'm so furious at these sorts. I may have egg on my face. I doubt it. Look, I understand that people have a very strong, passionate feeling about Donald Trump, but you're asking me to believe, and I don't know, you in particular, Harry, but these people with these odds are asking me to believe that the Republican Party of the United States is going to impeach their own president or force him to resign through the possibility of that. I think that's not going to happen. In theory, there's a smoking gun linking him to Russia that makes that inevitable, but I just don't buy it. I was looking earlier at the chances of the Democrats taking Congress in 2 years' time. And, I mean, the House is an interesting one because it requires the Democrats, I believe, to win the popular vote by quite a bit to take the House, maybe as much as 7 points, just because of the nature of how the boundaries are drawn. But in the Senate, there are 33 seats up, I think, in total, and 8 of them are Republican. Mm. So, you know, the rest, obviously, not being, so that's 25 Democrat or slash... That's right, yeah. 25 Democrats slash independent, because I think a couple of, as we know, Bernie Sanders, for example, isn't technically a Democrat. Controversial. And of those 8 states, we've got Mississippi, Tennessee, Texas, Nebraska, Wyoming, Nevada, Arizona, and Utah. I think that's 8.
It's not actually got the list in front of it. That is serious nerdery.
That is serious nerdery. They're all in the kind of pattern on the American map. And the Democrats have to take 3 of them. Those 8. So there's people I've been talking to on Twitter about this who have suggested, you know, okay, Arizona might be possible, this sort of thing. But it's very hard.
The different, like, the independent issues which govern each one. I don't know enough about American politics in minutiae to say whether they could be. But there are you do sometimes get Democratic.
The presidential election that's just gone was a particularly favourable one.
Yeah,
for Democrats, in terms of the seats that are up for the Senate. But anyway, leaving that to one side, I mean, the point is that listeners probably need to know is that it's quite hard, for, even with Trump very unpopular, it's quite hard for the Democrats to take the Senate. Isn't the be-all and end-all of the impeachment, of course.
Yeah, so you need to, if they were going to impeach Donald Trump, they would need to have 2/3 of the Senate anyway. So they would need to have Republicans to come onto their side. And in order for impeachment to happen anyway, there needs to be a kind of big old smoking gun to happen. So for impeachment to happen, you need to have 50% of the House of Representatives and then 2/3 of the Senate. Kind of that then puts him up to the impeachment trial, essentially, to which the Senate is effectively the jury, and 2/3 of the Senate have to vote to impeach the president. It doesn't look very likely at the moment, although you'd think that Trump is probably the biggest risk you can kind of think of having done something which would be...
That I will concede.
And if some of the allegations which have already been put out about him turn out to have some evidence, if a certain video does turn up, then that is potentially impeachable. And, you know, the Republicans are also aware that probably there is some kind of question mark about it, but were Trump impeached, then Mike Pence would be the president, and actually most Republicans would probably much prefer Mike Pence to be the president. It would be make their lives much easier than under Donald Trump.
That is true, although I would say that, yes, they'd like the idea of Mike Pence being president, but if you've got the Republican president impeached, you're not winning the next election.
I don't know.
I just don't buy it.
Well, particularly if Mike Pence is your candidate, right?
Oh, it depends who's running against him, I suppose. If Hillary Clinton runs again, then...
There was an article in Politico suggesting that might be that Hillary might run. Should she, Leo?
And this is your segue into fake news now, isn't it?
you're avoiding the question.
I was going to say, like, we did have a poll about that as well, about how many people want him to be impeached. And actually, the public opinion is important in the process of impeachment, because it's fairly... it's not clearly worded exactly what is required to have happened for a president to be impeached. And essentially, it's if the president is exceptionally unpopular, if people start writing into their representatives, then that's kind of what's going to go on. So 46% of people think he should be impeached already. That compares with, so in 2014, I think it was 35% of Americans wanted Obama to be impeached. So there's always a relatively high base level, even when there's not really a reason to impeach anyone. But it's an interesting thing and one to kind of keep a track on, I think.
So let's move on to fake news, when Richard Leo mentioned when he avoided the question of whether Hillary Clinton should run again.
I don't think the listeners need anyone to answer that.
So this was a poll that we noticed, which was conducted, when was it? At the end of January, so it's a couple of weeks old, actually, but it passed us by, I guess. We're not regular watchers of Channel 4. YouGov conducted this, well, Leo might be. YouGov conducted this poll for Channel 4 around fake news. It's a really, really interesting poll. Quite detailed, quite a lot of information in there. It's not just one or two questions. There's a lot of information to pore over. And I want to start off by looking at some of the numbers around how confident, if at all, are you that you could tell the difference between a fake news story and a real news story? And 49% said they would be confident in telling the difference. 37% said they would not be confident. How worried are you, if at all, about the effects of fake news? 49% worried, 42% not worried. So clearly there is some concern out there about this phenomenon. And I guess it does make me think that this is here to stay. This idea that you can just discredit news as a lie if it doesn't suit you feels like it's going to be something that people use to their benefit for a while, Harry.
So it's obviously actually kind of come into parlance in British politics as well, to the consternation of the Twitterati. I think Theresa May talked about alternative facts recently. I think last week Jeremy Corbyn called it fake news that he'd set out a schedule for his own departure and that he was facing challenges from his own sort of allies on the left of the Labour Party. Yeah, it's something which people are worried about, but... it's also not a very clear... There's not a very clear definition of it, and you can see why people wouldn't necessarily know what is fake news and what isn't, because actually I don't necessarily, because it depends on what the gradation really is. Where does the completely fake news start and hyperbole end? Is our Daily Express voodoo poll headline figures fake news? The answer is yes. But like, so it's not quite the same thing as Hillary Clinton, allegations about Hillary Clinton and a pizza place and paedophiles. Like, it's not clear where one begins and one ends, and it's troubling, I think, that the differences between them are kind of being blurred and put together under a fairly dodgy,
it's interesting, because I wonder,
umbrella term.
I wonder whether... So, obviously, the term fake news is a new one. But then you've always heard this idea, or you can't believe everything you read in the newspapers. It's a kind of phrase as old. I've always heard that phrase.
It's always been true.
It's always been true. So, like, I don't know, maybe this is just an extension of what we've always known. Before I go to you, Leah, there was a kind of amusing stat in here, which was that younger people were the most confident that they could tell what fake news was, and older people the least confident, yet older people were the least worried about it, which about fake news. So I don't know what that says about the so-called snowflake generation. But Leo, you were looking at some of this earlier.
Yeah, I mean, just on that point, it feels a bit like this is a concept that has emerged very much around the US election. Probably younger people who are a bit more into... I guess news sources that are sort of a bit more fun and a bit more American focused are probably hearing the term more, older people perhaps less. I've got a feeling, for exactly the reasons that you guys have just said, that about the difficulty of pinning down what the phrase means, that actually in the not too distant future people are going to stop using it. But the poll also asked about a few particular questions, where it gave people headlines and asked them whether they firstly had seen them and secondly whether they thought they were real or whether they thought they were fake news. And so all of these were stories that had been reported in the British media. And actually, I was sort of encouraged by the responses to them. So the top two stories that people thought were true, so this isn't whether they'd heard them, but whether they thought the story was fake news or not. One was about Tillerson and his close links with Putin. And one was a sort of boilerplate piece on a tourist and a selfie and a crocodile. And then the top three that they thought were fake was a bunch of cash being given to immigrants, Iceland throwing a party for asylum seekers, and I assume that that's the country Iceland, and political correctness about some villages being called Easter and having to change their names. So what seemed to be the case, which surprised me, and I thought was quite encouraging, was the stories that people aren't believing are the ones that have sort of been fodder for the Express for a long time.
The Express is taking a hell of a show this episode.
If we're talking about fake news, it's the
Express readers do tweet Leo Barassi.
Immigrants, scroungers, all that kind of stuff. People are kind of not believing those stories so much as other ones, which, given that progressives tend to worry that the tabloid press feed frenzies of fear and angst about scroungers, was interesting that those are the ones that are not so believed.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned immigration there, Leo, because that leads us neatly on to our third and final topic, which is the latest Polling Matters Opinium survey. And as regular listeners will know, we've been partnering with Opinium for a few weeks now on some polls. And what we're trying to do in the main is to bring more nuance and more new information to some of the issues that we already know are important in polls. So, for example, this week we know that immigration is a really important issue. As I said at the beginning of this broadcast, we know that it was critical in Britain voting to leave the European Union. But what we don't often get, we do get it sometimes, is some of the what's behind that, basically. So what we did was, quite simply, we put, I think, 9 statements in total to the British public, nationally representative sample, 2011 respondents, I believe, and we asked whether people agreed or disagreed with those statements or neither. Now, there are limitations to doing agree-disagree scales, and I'm sure we'll come on to them. I know that they're a bugbear of Anthony Wells at UK Polling Report, so if you're listening, Anthony, then you can start twitching shortly. But I think probably I'm going to go through some of these findings with you guys now, but let's start off with, I guess, a catch-all one, which was the statement, overall, immigration is good for the UK. 39% agreed, 29% disagreed, 32% said neither. What do we make of those numbers, Harry? Because it seems to suggest that the public is very divided, can't make up its mind.
Yeah, well, it depends on the way that you've asked the question. I think I haven't checked this with you all, so I assume that it's likely that it was it asked in the same battery, randomised with them. So the in a context where you're also asking, so we'll go through the other responses in a bit, but where you're also asking whether you think the current number of immigrants is too high and allowing them to say agree on that, so 65% of people agree on that one, that you're more likely to get people thinking more openly about what immigration means in both the positives and the negatives, and you've gone in this battery into to both sides of it. And people do, and this kind of shows that people have two kind of boxes they think about immigrants in, which is the nice nurse who is making sure that they're well and healthy, the guy at the bottom of their road who runs the local Chinese, who they like and want to be welcome, and they're okay. But then there's all these other guys who are out there somewhere taking out their jobs and social housing, and they have to wait behind them in the GPs while they're coughing profusely, who they have less, they're the ones that they're the bad guys, and the differentiation between the two is difficult. And I think that's kind of reflected in that actually most people think that immigration overall is a good thing. I think there is a view, and I'm not sure it covered in here, that actually immigration is good for the economy in particular, and that kind of comes across in lots of different polling. But it's also bad in other ways, and if you frame it in, you can frame the same question in lots of different ways, and you'll get very different responses.
And just to clarify that, because I think that was a really interesting point. So the implication of that is, if you give people an opportunity to respond to a poll question with the negatives about immigration, then they're more likely to also take an opportunity to express the positives.
Yes.
So if you just asked in isolation, is immigration good for the UK, without having also said, tell me how you feel about the impact of immigration on public services, then you'd expect the overall figure to be worse.
I'd imagine there's a priming
more
effect
negative.
There, yeah.
That's really interesting.
Let's look at some of these, some of the more nuanced or the more detailed questions. So there were three statements that got around two-thirds of the public agreeing with them. And I suppose by virtue of that, you could suggest that there is a consensus of sorts around them. Equally, no more than 14% or one in seven disagreed with them. So there seems to be a decent consensus on them. One is that 65% agreed that the current number of immigrants coming to the UK is too high. The another, so the same, 65% agreed that I want people that come to live and work here in the UK to feel welcome. So too many immigrants, but I hope they feel welcome. and then 68% that think immigration places too much pressure on public services like housing and the NHS. Now, Leo, you'll know from being on the show regularly with me, this is something that I just think isn't discussed enough. And I don't want to pass judgment on this podcast as to whether that's true or not. People will have really strong opinions on that either way. But I think this is the untold story of the whole immigration debate, and certainly doesn't get as much discussion in the news, at least I haven't seen it, that it should. I think that a large reason why people voted to leave the European Union last June was not just because immigration was too high or control over borders, but this perception that the consequence of that was negative for public services. And we've mentioned housing and the NHS here, but you could also mention, I don't know, perhaps schools or whatever. And again, I don't want to say that that is or isn't the case, but there seems to be a huge absence of debate, particularly on the left, but on all sides, frankly, as to A, whether that's true, and B, what we do about it, if it is true or isn't. It seems to be, it is the statement of the nine we tested that has the strongest agreement levels, the most consensus across party lines, across age groups and so on. Young people, old people, I mean, old people more likely to agree with it, but young people too. So I think it's a really, really important statement. I mean, Leo, what do you make of that and maybe some of the other findings I've just mentioned? So those three that have two-thirds agreeing with them.
It feels to me that there are two categories of statements and responses here. There's a set that are sort of macro for the economy, that all get a plurality, a net positive support, but not a majority. So
these are some of the other statements.
Immigrants are good for public services. Immigrants do the jobs that British workers won't do, and overall immigration is good for the UK. But there's a set of statements that are more micro and are more about how immigration affects people's everyday lives, which are, I think, the closer to the ones that you were talking about. They get much stronger support, so pressure on public services, make it harder to get jobs, and then overall immigration should be cut. And it sort of feels to me that the a so what about this that's quite politically relevant is given that Labour is led by a team who are looking for a position on immigration that is going to appeal to their supporters, and they are in a different different fiscal position than the last Labour opposition, it seems to me that if the concern about immigration is about public services, then a position that could work quite well for Corbyn and his team is, well, the answer to immigration is to spend more on public services. There doesn't seem to be an inherent opposition to immigration. It's a practical what it means for my everyday life. I'm surprised that they haven't pushed further on that position.
It seems to be something that I'll come to in a moment, Harry, that Labour struggles with, this idea that you try and neutralise an issue and then move the conversation onto territory that you're more comfortable with. So it used to be about public spending. I mean, when Ed Miliband stood up and said, oh no, the last Labour government didn't spend too much, he obviously believed that, but that was a problem because I think the public opinion was another way. So an easier way to move the conversation on would have been to say, yes, I think Labour did, but for these reasons, and here's what we're going to do next time. I feel like there seems to be, it would be ideal for Labour to have a similar argument with immigration. Granted, Ed Miliband tried it, which is that, you know, okay, we were too relaxed about immigration in the past. now we're leaving the European Union, here's what we think a fair immigration system looks like that gives us control. But by the way, the reason your public services are struggling is not because of immigration, it's because of, you know, conservative mismanagement or cuts or whatever. And it does seem to me that the Labour Party is just incapable, not just on immigration, on public but on public spending, on other issues too, of getting out of the garage on some of these issues and sort of neutralising them first and then moving them on to a territory where it's happiest.
I mean, immigration is a really, really big problem for Labour and has been for yonks now, but it's the same issue as with Remain or Leave, and obviously they're very deeply connected, but they have supporters from both ends of the spectrum and they need to try and keep both happy, and there's not a way of doing that very well. And I agree, obviously, the best way you want to be able to do it is say, shut up about immigration, I'm going to talk about the NHS now. But it's not always as easy as that. To be fair to Labour, I think they do have, and they kind of always have had for yonks again, fairly clear lines on housing and the NHS when it kind of, and especially when it is said in relation to immigration. So with the NHS, this idea that the NHS would collapse if
this one is a statement that says without foreign workers our public services would collapse is one of the statements we asked. 46% agreed with that statement, 27% disagreed, 26% said neither. So I guess you can either interpret that as a decent chunk more agree than disagree, but then it's not a majority that agree either.
Yeah, but I feel like that has really permeated through. You've heard that from so many different people. You're kind of sick of it if you watch the news enough, and that's the sign of a good kind of statement. That is an easy one for them to go with. With housing, similarly, there is a very obvious thing, which is the Conservatives haven't built enough houses for years and years and years. The reason why there's a problem with social housing is because they've not built any houses. We need to build more houses. We need to build more houses.
That message isn't there yet, though, is it?
I mean, I think that it's been said a lot. I think it's hard
but
to put out because
isn't on the Tories.
The blame isn't on the Tories as much as it is on the NHS, which is a problem for them, and they need to get that. And partially that's because actually when the Labour were in charge, people felt like the NHS improved because they threw a lot of money at it. And when the Labour weren't in housing, they just didn't, and it continued to be an issue and got worse under Labour, which is a problem. And then the way they'll have to deal with that is by coming up with a potential solution in exactly the way that the government haven't done, but that's going off slightly on a tangent.
Sure, and we'll be publishing the whole list of statements later this evening / tomorrow. One of the ones I thought was quite interesting was the statement, immigration makes little difference to my life personally. 42% agreed with that, 28% disagreed, 29% said neither. So there is, I guess, always this perception of what affects me personally. And that can mean, you know, my living standards or the public services I use, I guess. But then also what's affecting the country. And when people vote, there is a complex relationship between the two. Not everything has to be about me and my household, but obviously that's relevant as well. Last couple of minutes, let's finish by looking at our own sort of version of approval ratings. Let's finish what we started. But this time, looking at the UK, I don't want to spend too much time on this because we've kind of dealt with Theresa May versus Jeremy Corbyn a few times in recent weeks. But we asked approve, disapprove or neither. Theresa May's approval rating, 44% approve, 29% disapprove, 27% say neither. This isn't strictly comparable to what Donald Trump's numbers earlier, because there is no neither in the Gallup poll. You have to make a decision. Corbyn's approval rating, if you can call it that, 16% approve, 52% disapprove, 33% say neither. So if we were going to create a net rating there, May on plus 15, Corbyn on minus 36, I guess whichever question you ask, whichever numbers you use, May beats Corbyn. And we've been talking about that quite a lot in the last few weeks. But Leo, you were looking at some of the older leaders, weren't you? So the Tim Farron we asked about and Nicola Sturgeon.
So three standout things I'll go through quickly. In Scotland, small sample, so heavy caveats. Corbyn's numbers are pretty much as bad there as they are nationally, which I think is an important point, given that one of his major campaign goals was to get Labour back at the table in Scotland. Sturgeon's numbers in Scotland are only about the same, in fact slightly worse than May's nationally, which I found interesting given there's quite a strong narrative that Sturgeon is sort of unbeatable. And Farron, compared with Nuttall, is very similar, and both of them have 51 or 52% of people somewhere in the middle, which suggests to me, given that I was sort of starting
which in the absence of don't knows for that question could probably mean
that's exactly where I'm going, that Nuttall I'm sort of using as a proxy of a political leader that no one has heard of, that for Farron to be doing only as badly
welcome that
as
if that is actually
well,
true.
And the poll was taken before the late his disasters this week, so maybe that'll change. But my point is, Farron is really not doing well on name recognition, it seems.
Mm. I mean, what do you make of some of these approval ratings, Harry? It does seem like Theresa May walloping Jeremy Corbyn, but you know, some of the other leaders struggling to be heard.
Yeah, so I think in Scotland that sort of jibes with other polling, which has been done sort of specifically in Scotland, which previously showed that Theresa May is much more popular than Jeremy Corbyn, that Ruth Davidson is more popular than Jeremy Corbyn, and indeed Kezia Dugdale, and indeed Nicola Sturgeon. Obviously, the Tories are doing exceptionally.
If there was such a thing as a Scottish presidential election, I think Sturgeon would have a real problem versus
she
Ruth
would,
Davidson.
But,
there isn't, so
which is fascinating and like really interesting. You know, even like just a handful of years ago, you say that a Tory prime minister would be more supported than the Labour Scottish leader. You'd be laughed out of town, but it's true.
Mm.
So yeah, it's dramatic change. With Corbyn and May, it's same as if you don't have don't knows, then you can't track the most interesting bit, which is how Corbyn does against don't know, with don't know thrashing him usually.
They should elect don't know as Labour leader. Final word, I suppose, very briefly. What's our gut instincts on Copeland and Stoke? Obviously, that's next week. I'll start with you, Harry. Could go and finish with Leo, but I mean, we're shooting in the dark, aren't we? When we don't have polling data to go on. It feels to me like Nuttall's crashing and burning in Stoke, and that Labour will probably be okay there. Copeland, we don't know, but the Tories are throwing a lot at it. But I wonder whether this might be another example of Jeremy Corbyn's low expectations helping
coming out. Well, yeah, like the media bubble kind of view is that it's likely that the Tories will take Copeland and Labour will retain Stoke on the basis that Paul Nuttall has shot himself in the foot. And just on the kind of view that Nigel Farage is refusing to go to Stoke and Theresa May is going up to Copeland suggests that they know something that we don't. That isn't always true, as by-elections have frequently proven. So far, you know, the by-elections haven't gone terribly. Old local elections, really, compared with the low expectations and the low poll ratings nationally that Corbyn has had. As always, as you'll hear on everyone talking about the by-elections, they don't necessarily mean anything for the next government. In some ways, that's actually a good thing for Jeremy Corbyn, because people know that they're voting for their local representative and are not. It's very clear that Corbyn won't become Prime Minister as a result of it.
That's interesting.
At the same time, in Copeland, they apparently haven't absolutely not media savvy person. I think they brought in the wife of someone who works at Sellafield, which makes sense, and like, was a politically kind of interesting savvy person, but she hasn't gone down, my understanding is she hasn't gone down as well as one would hope on the doorstep, so the strength of the candidate is also something which will be very interesting in both, with obviously Gareth Snell having had some problems with his old tweets.
Yes, Guido's got hold of Gareth Snell. Leo, I guess final word to you. We often deride the fabled ground game, particularly on the left, given it was supposed to win Ed Miliband, Remain and Hillary Clinton, the various elections that they were in. But I actually, that's probably an exaggeration just to dismiss it. And in a by-election, it's quite important, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it helps. I think if you've got an established operation, you're in a better place. I think these are two wins for Labour, and if they're not, it's a sackable offence for Corbyn. So ignore all expectation management.
Well, the chairman that is the Labour Party membership has a lot of patience, I think, with their manager. Anyway, on that slightly hashed football metaphor, a big thanks to Leo Barassi and Harry Carr for joining me this week. Certainly a lot covered. Join us next week when we'll be talking about probably pre and post the Copeland and Stoke by-elections, which I imagine will be be the main political story to talk about. That is, of course, unless Donald Trump's done something else since then, in which case I'm sure we'll cover that too.
Sure.
But in the meantime, if you do like what you hear, please subscribe on iTunes or other Android-related or other sort of podcast apps. Do give us, do like our Facebook page. And most importantly, do share the podcast with other people. It's a great way of getting our sort of shows out there. We still get, believe it or not, even after 2.5 years, new people listening to the show and saying how much they enjoy coming across it, even though it's been going a little while. So it does help when people share it. But in the meantime, thanks for listening, and join us again next week for some more polling and political analysis.